Hello, this is Raleigh Burley with the Sober Sun, and Colorado Inside Out is not on. That was our fond April Fool's joke. I'm here with Ken Pletcher, and we are back, the Sober Sun on Katie and Kay. So Ken Pletcher is one of our correspondents who has been faithfully writing articles for the past 2 years or so. Ken, how are you doing?
Doing well, thanks.
And this is the first episode in quite a while, but we will be back on Katie and Kay every Thursday at 4 p.m. interviewing guests and talking about the week's paper. So to begin, we'll have a little bit of a handful of hosts that will be carrying this show, and Ken is going to be one of them, and I want to go through introducing each of them. My name is Raleigh Burley. I'm the editor of the Sober Sun, and so Ken, what attracted you to writing for the Sober Sun? Do you have a background in journalism?
No, I don't. My background's actually in reference publishing. I was with Encyclopedia Britannica for 3.5 decades, and I was an editor there, working on content, both short articles and very long ones. One of our neighbors is involved with The Sun and said, oh, you should write for them. So I actually started out, I did a little freelance fact-checking, copy editing for you before I actually started as a correspondent in the January of 2019.
Ken, you're one of the correspondents that I need to be really sure if I'm going to edit anything of your work that I mean it, because you've got that experience yourself.
Oh, yes. I tell you, when I was an editor, we had these this copy department that was vigilant, would be a mild way to put it. And so I had to learn real fast to do things correctly, or I'd have all sorts of red ink on my back then with real paper copy before we went digital.
And so our guest on today's show is related to your most recent piece, which is about the fire department.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a little teaser. We will have Rob Goodwin, the fire chief, on with us in just a few minutes. But Ken, I also wanted to introduce our theme song for this new iteration of Everything Under the Sun. It turns out that you have many talents.
Well, I've been playing guitar for a long time. As most kids my age in the 60s, we were pretty besotted by all the pop music out there, and I had to learn how to play guitar and sing. It was too much fun not to. So I've been pretty much ever since.
Well, you're having an editorial meeting to discuss the show and where we wanted to take it and what we wanted to do differently, and right off the bat, when I mentioned, hey, if we could find a good instrumental version, you were on it. You said, hey, I've got a 12-string guitar, and you played both parts, yeah, a 6-string and a 12-string.
Yeah, that was fun. It was inspired by a show many years ago on SNL when George Harrison played that song with Paul Simon, two of my, idols in music, and they just did an acoustic version with the guitars in different tunings, and it sounded really fantastic, and I'd known the song for years, but I just said, oh, I gotta find some people to play that with, and it's been fun. So in this iteration, I just did the two parts. I kind of made up the second one on the 12-string.
It was a new experience for me doing the audio mix down on a song like that, and figuring out how to get you listening to one guitar while playing the second.
Mm-hmm.
So, without further ado, let's play our theme song, and we'll get Fire Chief Rob Goodwin on the phone.
Because of her father's support on.
Oops.
Thank you.
Hey, yo, thanks so much for that.
I realize, since I've never played this together.
Oh, yeah, we left a little bit of that in there.
Mm-hmm.
So, wonderful version of that song, Ken, and thank you so much for contributing those talents to the Soper Sun as well.
Glad to do it.
So, if I did this correctly, then we have Fire Chief Rob Goodwin on the phone. Rob, are you there?
Hey.
Yeah,
thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks so much for joining us, not only for Ken's most recent article in the newspaper, but also taking the time this afternoon to join us on the radio.
You bet. Hi, Ken.
Hi, Rob. How are you doing?
Good.
We were trying to decide, you know, what guests we wanted to stack up for this show going forward, and Ken came at me and said, wow, that guy has a lot of stories, and so the perfect opportunity. So the headline news item on this article is the new equipment that the fire department has. So let's start there. Tell us about your new trucks.
Sure. We bought the trucks out of a bond issue that the voters of the district approved in 2018, in November of 2018. And so through 2019 and 2020, we had done the specifications on the truck and the ordering process, and to get a truck like that, it takes about a year. So that was the process for it. The planning for it came out of our master plan that we finished in 2015 and 2016, and we had identified stations that needed work done, additions, and apparatus that needed to be replaced. And as you probably saw in the article, they're replacing some pretty old vehicles. And so, yeah, it's one part of that bond issue that was approved coming out of our master plan. We're just basically trying to follow through with that.
Well, it was a fun opportunity, speaking on the new equipment, to also look a little bit at the history of the fire department.
Yeah. Yeah, I really enjoyed that. It was interesting digging in. I had some help from John Williams, who's a local history buff, and found out some interesting facts and some kind of a little bit conflicting information, as you can guess from going that far back. But it was really interesting finding out how the fire district itself came into being.
And amazing to see how it's evolved to be what it is today. And so you're also constructing a training facility, is that right?
Yeah, we are. It'll be on a piece of property right next to our administration building. It's something that we've been dreaming about and planning for 15 or more years. And it was also part of that master planning and the bond process. And we hope to break ground in the middle of May and be done by the end of October, middle of October. And it's very exciting. It's a true multifunction training building. Many fire departments have burn buildings where you can do live, you know, fire training burns. But our vision for it for years has been to do as many of the disciplines as we do. We do, and the largest thing we do are emergency medical calls. So it is built so that we can run emergency medical calls through it, fire calls, rescue stuff, and live burn and that kind of thing. And so we kind of see it as a regional asset for fire departments really all over the Western Slope and the state, and bring in training symposiums and things like that on top of us locals being able to use it as regularly. We're very excited.
It was interesting to me looking at the history of the Carbondale and Rural Fire Protection District, which really began humbly with a lot of volunteers, and now we're working towards having this very professional facility. How do you think that correlates with the increased, would you say there is a correlation, or there is more of a proliferation of a need to fight fires? Are we experiencing a heightened danger of fire?
Yeah, I think it goes with population.
Mm-hmm.
The way your community grows, your fire department grows. And when I started with Carbondale Fire in the mid-80s, we had one paid person and the rest of us were volunteers. And it has, you know, evolved over the years into a combination department where we have a number of paid career people along with volunteers as well. And I see that going that way for a long time, the combination. And it goes with our call volume. As more people are here, our call volume goes up, and the need to really be well trained. Training is really the golden key for us, and for any emergency service. And fires, let's take house fires or structure fires. Today, they're more dangerous than they've ever been because of lightweight building materials.
Interesting.
And modern furnishings and things like that, they burn way faster, way hotter. The floors don't last as long. The roof doesn't last as long under fire conditions. So although you may not have as many, they're more dangerous when you go in. So mm-hmm. the only way to be able to crack that nut is to really train.
I suppose there's homes a lot more densely located
yes.
as well.
Yep, that's true. And then we have the wildfire component as well, which is a big one around here, as everybody knows.
Right.
It's one of the biggest things we do. That's one of the reasons we bought these five fire apparatus. They are truly dual-purpose apparatus designed for structure fires and designed to fight wildfires to get the best bang for our buck.
What are some of those specs that make them ideal for fighting wildland fires?
Well, we have two trucks that are called tenders or tankers. They haul in a structure fire thing where there are no hydrants, they will haul water to the fire, right, for our engines and the people putting out the fire. And they each carry 1,500 gallons of water. And in a wildland fire, they have 1,500 gallons of water. They're four-wheel drive. They have a little turret, like a turret on the front of it that's remotely controlled from the cab, where you can drive out into a brush fire scene and start extinguishing it from the cab, a real pump and roll thing, and spray bars under the bumpers that'll spray the ground. Plus, they have foam capability and that kind of thing. So they're called a tactical tender in the fire world. And I really think these two things are game changers for us.
Mm-hmm.
And then as far as the three engines go, they are regular structure fire engines, but they're also four-wheel drive, and they're designed specifically with the rear and the front are designed so they can go down through ditches and stuff. It's called approach and departure angle. And they've got foam on them and a turret and a bunch of a wildfire capability as well.
Oh, neat. One of the things that I remember when I was talking with you last week, Raleigh touched on this with the volunteerism, and I know that is really important to the organization. And if I remember correctly, there were new volunteer recruits who are actually in training on that day.
Yeah, that was a bit fortuitous that day. Yeah. We were doing a training with our recruits. We got 10 volunteers that joined in January, and mm-hmm. they've been doing our recruit academy training, and we're very excited to be adding them. They're a great group of folks, and like I said before, there's no way we could do this, what we do, over 300 square miles, Marble, Redstone, Carbondale, Missouri Heights, up to Elgeval. There's no way we could do it without volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're just an integral part of what we do.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the tenders are going to be, one is going to be in Carbondale, and the other one, is that going to be in Marble? Is that what I remember?
Yeah, yes.
Uh-huh.
We have other tenders.
Yeah.
In the district, but mm-hmm. those were the two. Were the two really, you know, 47-year-old trucks.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. So you'll keep those in service, but rely more on the new equipment. Is that kind of the plan?
Those two tenders were actually a deal we had with the Colorado State Forest Service for years.
Mm, okay.
And so they're taking those back. And some other fire department in Colorado will get one or two of them that really need them. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Well, we've heard a lot in recent years about firefighters traveling out of state to help mm-hmm. out big fires in other places. Does our local fire district participate a lot with that?
That's a great question, and yes, we do. Last year, we went out on 7 deployments.
Wow.
And let's see, we went to Southern Colorado twice. We were on the Pine Gulch Fire near Grand Junction. We were on a thing called the August Complex in Northern California by Redding, and then the 2 big fires on the Front Range. And a couple, and the Grizzly Creek Fire, and others. And through the years, if we have, it's a really a kind of a, it's a timing and staffing thing because we have to look at what are the conditions here, what are our staffing levels when the federal firefighting agencies call for help, and if we're able to staff it and do that and maintain the same level of response here, we'll do it. If we can't, we don't take the deployment. But we've done it many times over the years. We believe in trying to help, number one, because when we need help, we're going to want them to come here as well.
Right.
And the other thing it does is it gives you the people you send great experience on these larger fires so that when they come back here, they can teach, plus we have a much more experienced group fighting any wildfire that might happen here. So I see it as a benefit all the way around.
Yeah, I wondered if you wanted to. One of the things I remember seeing in the headquarters building there was that photo of that extraordinary photo of the Lake Christine fire's first night, when you were able to stop the fire just short of El Jebel. I remember seeing that. I was out of state at the time and looking at a photo of it and thinking, how in the world did you do that?
Yeah, that fire got pretty sporty that night. And, you know, it had burned towards basalt all day.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we did most of the evacuations and structure protection during the day. And we had ordered a lot of resources from everywhere during the day,
mm-hmm.
And we had a Type 2 incident management team that was going to be taken over the next morning. And so we were basically just getting stuff together to put in structure protection for the night and let everybody else get some rest and hit it again in the morning. And we had a really strange wind and weather event that night. 35-40 mile an hour down valley winds at night that made it roar to life back towards El Jebel, and that was, we hadn't evacuated El Jebel, and when I look back at it, what they did there when they made that stand and those crews did the burnout operation in there, it was exactly what we hoped would happen. You had some really experienced leadership in that group with pretty aggressive firefighters working for them that was able to accomplish something that was extremely difficult.
Yeah.
And it was because we had really experienced people, because the decision was we're either going to make a stand and try to protect this place or everybody just run and mm-hmm. we'll try to protect it west of El Jebel after it burns down. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the kind of decision making you're forced into. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So fortunately, it came out the way it came out.
I was wondering, in the time that we have left, if you could share a bit of a prognosis for well, what's to come based on conditions as they are right now?
Every month we get new, what are called extended outlooks from the National Weather Service, and we meet local fire departments and the BLM and Forest Service. We talk about it, and we just got one. It's predicting, and this has been kind of a theme for, I don't know, about a year and maybe a year and a half, drier than normal and higher than average potential for large wildfires into July and maybe August. And it'll be before July up through June. It'll be either a little bit above average or quite a bit above average potential. So it's still dry. I think we're still in a drought cycle, and it's concerning for us. I don't predict fire seasons anymore because I've always been wrong. If I say it's going to be a bad year, then it rains. So I quit trying to predict them. But the outlook right now is not very good.
So you spoke to some volunteers, and I imagine it's a process, but it sounds like there's always going to be a need, a robust need, and now with this training facility, a greater capacity to receive volunteers.
Absolutely.
How do people go about that?
Well, just call the Carbondale Fire Station, 963-2491, and say I'm interested in volunteering. Or they can go on our website, carbondalefire.org, and there's a way to link up to get information on volunteering or our Facebook page.
All right. So once again, 963-2491 is the phone number.
Yep.
We do have a few minutes left. Ken, do you have any lingering questions?
Well, I was just wondering if you wanted to talk a little bit about the paramedic and ambulance service. That was one of the more interesting aspects of how it was handled in Carbondale in the old days. Apparently, it was the responsibility of morticians in Glenwood Springs to provide ambulance service, which I'm imagining was not exactly timely.
Conflict of interest.
Yeah.
Right.
And then slowly the town acquired an ambulance, and you started more robust training with paramedics and EMT folks, and until you got to the point now, might want to talk about what the situation is now.
You know, when I first moved here in the late 70s, the fire department had their first ambulance, and it was an old hearse that had been converted into an ambulance. And over the years, we upgraded, and I joined in the mid-80s, and we had a couple of ambulances. And, paramedics are the standard of care in this country for emergency medicine. So that's always been our goal. And as we've evolved and gone to a combination department, our goal has always been to have two paramedics on each shift so that we can run back-to-back calls. That's something we didn't really talk about, Ken, but we have a lot of what we call concurrent calls where we'll go out on a smoke report, and then we'll have a chest pain and or another ambulance call. They just kind of all happen in bunches. So we want to be able to provide that care no matter what the call is. And so that's what we've done. We've gone to that level where we have two paramedics per shift on our five-person shifts, and just because that is the standard of care. And paramedic is a different level than being an EMT. Advanced cardiac life support and, a couple of years worth of class training and field training and that kind of thing. But our paramedics are a great group.
I'll attest to that.
Well, thank you so much for your service, Fire Chief Rob Goodwin, and for joining us on today's show.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
And thank you, Ken, for all of your good work with the Soper Sun, for writing this story and all the stories to come.
It's been a real pleasure doing it.
All right. Well, have a great afternoon, everybody.
Okay.
Thanks. Take care. All right. Bye-bye.
once again, you can catch Everything Under the Sun every Thursday at 4 p.m. here on KDNK.